So take your Bibles and turn with me to Ruth, chapter 4, the last chapter. This may be my last message in the book of Ruth, but I don't believe so. I believe that there is another message yet to be brought, and so I'm anticipating next week finishing up in Ruth. However, this would satisfy a concluding message in this book. You'll see why at the end of it. But next week, I believe what I would like to do is to pull it all together and look at what I believe is the underlying theme of the book of Ruth. But we will be looking at this chapter this morning and seeing what God has for us here. So would you stand with me, please, as I read Ruth chapter 4. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the Redeemer, of whom Boaz had spoken, came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Then he said to the Redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it, in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me, that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you." And he said, "I'll redeem it." Then Boaz said, "The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance." Then the Redeemer said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm a transaction. The one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. Also Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together build up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception. And she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than 7 sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. And may the Lord add his blessings to the reading, and you may be seated. As I said, we're at the end of the story. And all good stories have surprises at the end. If you're a writer of any type of book, you will write it so that there is a surprise at the very end of it. It's usually consistent, though, with what has been set up, even though it is a surprise. You'll say, "Boy, I didn't see that coming." But then when you look back over the movie or you look back over the storyline, you said, "You know what? I should have seen it coming," even though it seems to be a surprise at the end. The plot twists, it turns, writer takes you in different places, and it's exactly the same thing that we find here in the book of Ruth in chapter 4. Now, if you remember where we left off chapter 3, remember we looked at that last week and we saw where Ruth goes into Boaz at the threshing floor. Depending upon your position on that, whether it was questionable or not, it remained very moral and very above board. But nevertheless, there was a surprise to her when we left her last week, and that was, hey, Ruth, Boaz speaking, hey, Ruth, there is another redeemer closer than I. I will redeem you, but there is one who is closer and in essence has first right to redeem you before I would. But nevertheless, if he will not redeem you, I will redeem you. And so what this means is that Ruth and Naomi fundamentally are taken care of. At this point, their need for physical protection has basically been taken care of. One way or the other, they are going to be redeemed. One way or the other, they're going to protect it, either by mysterious Mr. X, or it's going to be by Boaz himself. But the suspense that we have here built into chapter 4, at the beginning of it at least, is the question, okay, they're taken care of, but what about Ruth in her marriage and, you know, that whole thing that goes along with that and her happiness and her lineage being carried on? And what about all of that? We get a sense, though, right off the bat, if you read it for the first time, if you would be reading Ruth for the first time, you'd come to this and you'd have a certain feeling that, well, Mr. X is in the wings, but he's really not right. He's really not right for her. We get a sense that Boaz seems to be the right man, but we don't know that. The choice of husband is not the only issue to be resolved here in this final scene. You're going to see an amazing twist, an amazing plot, if you will, that the writer brings into it. At the very end, you're going to see that this story is much more than simply bringing two very, very, very worthy people together and to providing for them. You're going to see that this twist is beyond that. It's beyond those certain individuals, that there's an overarching storyline here, that God is in the process of paving the way for a king for his people. Keep in mind, they know nothing of a king. It's in the time of the judges. So they do not have a king. They're not even really rumbling about it. They're not talking about it yet. But yet we see God is paving the way for this king. So what you see here, it's not just a story of God's faithfulness. One of my favorite words in the Old Testament, and you've heard me say it many times, I know, is the Hebrew word hesed, H-E-S-E-D. God's faithful love, his faithful covenant-keeping promise. That's the word hesed. And what you see here is not just God's covenant faithfulness to Naomi and to Ruth. It's about God's covenant faithfulness to Israel also. And in turn, I submit to you that it's also a picture and a story of God's hesed, his faithfulness to you and I today. Nowhere in here do you see anything about a king until the very end. It's foreign to the nation of Israel at this time to even be thinking about a king. But God is in the midst of already preparing, already within his sovereignty, already in the process of laying out this kingship already. So let's look at chapter and see how this opens up. Chapter opens up basically with Mr. So-and-so. Now, it's interesting because several of my commentaries all said the same thing, Mr. So-and-so. And when you see that kind of thing within commentaries, you go back to find out, well, who wrote the first commentary? Everybody copied off this guy, okay, because that's what they're all saying. Not necessarily. You'll see why. But the chapter opens up this way. Boaz wasting no time. Remember, he tells Ruth to go home. And he said, tomorrow I will begin to take care of this. I will redeem you, and tomorrow I will begin to take care of this. So he wastes no time in this resolution that he has made to Ruth. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down, and he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. So here's the picture. At the town gate, outside of the towns during the time of that we're talking about, or in ancient East, where all business was transacted and legal matters were decided. They didn't have a courthouse where they could actually go in and have a judge. It was elders of the city would gather on the outside of the town gate, and it was kind of an open forum where legal disputes were handled, business transactions were done, and that's what we have here. And so we see Boaz setting this up, and it isn't very long before Mr. X, the mysterious redeemer who is closer to Naomi, comes by. And he calls him over and has him sit down. Now, it's interesting. We don't know who this guy is. And there's no name given to him. And if you look at the writings, the way it is written, it appears that the writer goes to quite a bit lengths to give this guy no name. Because the Hebrew word is something along the line of Pelonai Almonai. Pelonai Almonai. And what it basically means, it's a rhyming word that basically, in essence, means nothing. And so really, in our kind of day and age, it would be so-and-so. You know, you've said that before. You know, oh, what's that guy's name? So-and-so. You know, I forget his name. He's the guy none of us like. Remember him? So-and-so. Or, hey, it's that guy we really like, but we all forget his name. So-and-so. It's that type of thing. It's a meaningless phrase, and it goes to great lengths to put that in here. So it's intentional that we don't know who this guy is. We just know him as Mr. So-and-so. And so now he said, Mr. So-and-so, have a seat over here. Once again, if you remember 2 weeks ago, I think it was, you saw the way that Boaz actually asked Ruth, almost for a commitment, that there is a close, no, this is last week, this is a closer redeemer. So make a proclamation now that you're serious about me marrying you. And so there was a sense that Boaz, even then, as worthy and as a great man of character, he was also shrewd. And so he has a scheme here that he's doing. And so he's sitting outside the gate, and he sees him come by. And he says, hey, Mr. So-and-so. Probably at the time he knew his name, but we don't have it recorded. He says, have a seat here. And now he seats a few other people. He seats a panel of witnesses. He brings the elders together. And so you got a picture that the guy, that Mr. So-and-so, has to have an idea that something's about to happen. I mean, he's putting some elders here in front of us, and this is a business transaction. This is a legal deal that is going to occur here. And he instantly broaches the subject once he has everybody in place. Verse 3, then he says to the redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to her relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you'll not tell me, then I may know, for there is no one beside you to redeem it, and I come after you. And he said, I'll redeem it. And so you see what's happened here. He's in essence saying, hey, Mr. So-and-so, Naomi has a field. She needs to sell it because she needs to make some money. She needs to be able to live. She needs to be able to have some type of income. Once again, come to in table talks and we'll discuss that a little bit further, because it literally was not the field that would be being sold the way you and I think of that. It's the rights to the field. It's the produce off of the field, because Year of Jubilee is going to give it back to the original owner. Okay, so keep this in mind. So really what he's selling here is the produce that comes off of the field. There's a twist to that, and we'll only discuss that down in table talks. But that's in essence what he's saying. Hey, Naomi has this field, and she needs to sell it. She needs to make money. If there's a kinsman redeemer, as we call this in our Jewish nation, he can buy that field, and he can keep it in the family. And think about it. If the buyer buys it and keeps it within the family, he gets to add that to his inheritance if there's no children involved. Ah, no children involved. He's got to be thinking along those lines. And you're the first in line. You're the first in line. You interested in this? Now, Mr. So-and-so is a shrewd businessman. So what he's looking at, say, oh, yeah, I'll take it. Absolutely, I'll redeem it to add to my inheritance. He agrees instantly to it, without giving a whole lot of forethought to it, because all he can see at this particular point is to adding to his inheritance at this particular point for a little bit, not much, but it's land. It's more, and you'll see that in Sunday school, how important land was to these people during this particular time. And so he's adding to his inheritance. And so he instantly agrees to it. And then Boaz springs a surprise on him. Then Boaz, verse 5, then Boaz said, "The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the Lord in his inheritance. Oh, by the way, now that you've agreed to buy it, you also get Ruth, the foreigner, the Moabitess. Remember her, don't you? She comes along with the package deal because you must marry her based upon Levirate marriage during that particular time. You're going to redeem this as the kinsman redeemer. You also get Ruth, and therefore you must carry on his lineage. You must have children to him, to her." And so you see this kind of twist that Boaz puts at it, puts it to the guy. And now, what's he say? What's the Mr. So-and-so say? Then the redeemer said, "I can't redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Wait a minute. Marriage? Now, first off, you told me I could buy a field. You told me I was going to be able to add to my inheritance. Now, that's okay. But marriage? Other kids? You mean I'm going to have to invest some money in here? Oh, no. He backs up like I back up when I see a snake in the woods. Except I scream like a little girl. We don't see Mr. So-and-so screaming like a little girl here, but it's the same picture. Okay, you just back up instantly. You recoil from this. What a moment for this guy. What seemed like a sure real estate deal. All he had to do was take care of an old lady. Take care of an old lady. Ain't going to be much. Feed another mouth. Naomi, she's not that big. She doesn't eat that much. I know her. So all I have to do is take care of her, and when she passes away, the field's mine. Wow. But instantly, it becomes an investment nightmare, something that he's agreed to. I didn't want to invest money, because you're saying that if I invest money into that I have to take Ruth, and we have to have kids, so I'm going to invest this money. Ruth and I will have kids, and because it's in the family and the way that it's to be handed down, Ruth and my kid is going to get it, and maybe I have other kids already involved in this. This is too much. He wasn't interested. Mr. So-and-so wasn't interested in ministry of mercy. He wasn't interested in ministry to the poor at this particular time because there was no payoff for him involved in this. He was only looking at it from a short-term perspective. Well, generosity was one thing, but this is a costly move. This is costly ministry without any payoff. Forget it. I don't want any part of it. Now, the irony here in this whole story is this, that by him seeking to protect his own future legacy, because that's what he talks about. No, I have other inheritance I have to give out, and you'll see how important that is in this way of life. He's so concerned about his future legacy that Mr. So-and-so himself is going to be left nameless. He was so worried about making a name for himself, about handing down his own inheritance to be able to hand it so that his name was in the lineage. Who is he? Does anybody know his name today? It's Mr. So-and-so in all of the scriptures and all of the writings. Nobody remembers him. And so by virtue of him trying to protect his own legacy, he leaves himself nameless. And the greatest irony is that by virtue of thinking the way he did, he left himself out of the greatest legacy mankind could ever have been a part of, the legacy of the plan of redemption and salvation that God was going to bring to people. He was letting himself out of that. And all because he thought he had outwitted him. Oh, I'm not going to do that. There's nothing in it for me. But Boaz takes an amazingly different approach to it. He takes a sacrificial approach to it. He embraces the opportunity of leaving a legacy for someone else. This isn't about Boaz's legacy, as we can see in these next couple of verses. This isn't about me, Boaz says. This is about the legacy of Ruth, Naomi, and her husband, their husbands at this time. Listen to what he says. Now, this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. what a weird way, by the way, to confirm a transaction. But anyways, to confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders, and this is the point of this. This is where you see Boaz's intentions of this. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon. Also, Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day. It's amazing, and I wish I had time to do this study, but this chapter, chapter 4, has all the way through it. If you remember last week, I was trying to determine how to preach chapter 3 until it finally struck me the bookends. Okay, the bookends of chapter 3 was kind of like right in front of me. I'm seeking rest. Naomi was saying to Ruth, I'm going to seek rest, and at the very end, Boaz isn't going to rest. There was what you needed to see and to kind of key in on that chapter. Well, I believe that when you look at chapter 4 here, you see that this is all about preserving names. It's about preserving names in the Old Testament. And so how the culture really functioned was in the preservation of names. If you could maintain, especially through males, be able to maintain the lineage, to be able to maintain your name, to say in the lineage this, and this. This is who followed who, and this is who begat who, was so important to them. And we see in chapter 4 here, you think about it, the names of Elimelech and Mahlon in 4 verse 10. You see the wishing that the blessing that Boaz's name would be remembered in Bethlehem. The similar blessings at the birth of Obed, about Obed's name. As a matter of fact, in verse 14, you even see it. There's a double naming. The women named him, and then instantly it says, and they named him. So twice you see, in one verse talking about Obed, twice you see his name mentioned. And then it ends, the entire chapter ends with what? A list of names. And so you see there's this common thread throughout this. And this is what Boaz looked at properly, whereas Mr. So-and-so didn't. Now, neither of these guys, neither Mr. So-and-so nor Boaz, realized at the time the name that was at stake here. None of them could conceive what we were about to see. The writer of this has waited to the very end to put that twist to it. The one who married Ruth, neither of these saw this. The one who married Ruth wasn't merely getting a woman of great character, a woman who has an amazing work ethic. And as we saw last week, an amazing fact that a woman who can carry 80 pounds of barley into the city without breaking a sweat. That's who you want to marry, okay? There's a worker there, all right? Even to say, this is what they're getting in Ruth. Now, you're not merely getting that. But you're getting to receive a place in the redemptive plan of God. Neither of them would have seen that. You see, Boaz and Ruth, their line is going to go to Obed, who's going to be the father of Jesse, who's going to be the father of King David. And we know King David's line, the messianic line, is going to lead us eventually to Jesus Christ. It was amazing. So here's Mr. So-and-so trying to protect his own future. And he forever remains nameless because he miscalculated in God's math. My notes here have new math. I've seen some of the new math that they're teaching today. It ain't math. Okay, I don't know why they call it that. But God has a new math. And I did want to take a look at that this morning. How often do we calculate our involvement in different things within church ministry, within personal ministry, within evangelism, on the same scale as Mr. So-and-so did, without putting God and his purposes and his law into the equation? We consider whether or not I should be involved in ministry, evangelism, or personal ministry at all. And we always ask the question, in essence, well, really, what's in it for me? How much time is it going to cost me? Is it going to fulfill me? Am I going to get any type of enjoyment out of it? Am I going to counsel? Am I going to make meals? Am I going to sit with people? Am I going to visit? What am I going to feel better about this? Is it going to cost me money? Is it going to cost me time? Is it going to cost me ease of mind? Is it going to cost me comfort to be involved in ministry? Is it going to cost me all of this stuff? And when we do it based upon the traditional worldly math, guess what we come out at the end of? It ain't worth it. We have this idea that we know for a fact that 2 and 2 is 4. At least under old math, it was. Now, if you feel that it should be 4, it's okay, I guess. But 2 and 2, we know, is 4. And so we calculate whether to be involved in ministry based upon all that. And what we do is we take out of it the fact that God Himself is in the midst of this. And it isn't about us. It isn't about me perpetuating a name for myself. But it's like Boaz. It's perpetuating a name for others. It's in obedience to God. It's in trying to find ourselves completely in the midst of what God wants. Because if we don't, we add it up into our own math. We have no idea what kind of blessings we're missing. Mr. So-and-so had no idea what blessings that he was missing. See, when we look at Ruth, look at this entire book of Ruth, we see that God's kingdom has a new math to it. A new math which this church has been studying over the last year or so in some of our refresh classes and some of the other classes that we've been teaching. It's a new math. So for us to find ourselves in fullness or completeness or joy or comfort, we have to walk through the opposite. So if we want fullness, we seem that God's math says you have to walk through some emptiness. You want completeness? We're going to have to walk through some partialness. Oh, you want joy? You're going to have to walk through some sorrow. You want comfort? You may have to walk through some suffering. That's God's math. That's not the traditional math that we think in our. That's Mr. So-and-so's math. This is what I'm looking for, and this is what's going to be a good deal on its face. In reality, God is working behind the scenes and saying, no, you calculate based upon my math. Because the consequences of things lost can be amazingly great. Think about Naomi. Think about what she has lost earlier in this book. She lost all of her earthly fullness, didn't she? Remember in the beginning of it, she said, I went away full. Me and Elimelech went away full. God has brought me back empty. I'm empty. And so we see this contrast in what God is walking her through as opposed to what Mr. So-and-so calculated it could be. Naomi had to lose everything. Everything. She lost her husband. She lost 2 sons. And what does she come back with? She comes back with baggage in the form of Ruth. That was her position. That's how she understood it. And yet she had to lose all of that for her to be able to see the loving kindness and grace of God through the person of Ruth herself. Would never have understood. You and I would never even know the name Naomi if she had not lost everything. And so God had a purpose for that. God walked her through this loss to give her everything, as you will see here at the very end. Took your sons, yes, but you have Ruth. Oh, she's worth more than 7 sons to you. Now, once again, don't use this as counseling to people who have lost children. Don't do that. That's not what this meant during this particular time. What was being said here was the amazing grace that God has given you in the person of Ruth can't even be measured in the fact that you lost a son. It's so much more amazing to say the fullness of God has been laid upon me than anything that I have suffered or walked away from. And we see it in Boaz with this, when he went to school for this new math. He's an A student, isn't he? He's an A student in this. He figured this out right from the beginning. He had an open heart for the poor. Remember his generous behavior toward Ruth when she was really nobody in a field gleaning? Whose woman is that? didn't even know who it was. Well, you let her stay. He had no intentions of anything further other than just an open heart, an open generosity that God had commanded him to do. He knew the God of grace. He knew what he had been given. And he therefore exemplified that and showed that continually. He wasn't marrying her here for anything that he was getting out of a good deal on. He wasn't simply saying, I'm getting a woman who can carry 80 pounds of barley. He wasn't doing it for that particular reason. He actually is marrying a Moabitess. He knows what it is. He knows the stigma that is going to remain with her. He knows all about that. He was entering into a relationship so that she could have a son to carry on the lineage and the inheritance of Elimelech and Mahlon. It wasn't about him. His math took into consideration obedience to the God of the covenant. Part of that math always includes putting aside what this world thinks of us and putting in place what the Lord thinks of us. So often we're worried about how we're perceived or how it's going to look to other people. Should I say something to this stranger? Should I say something because I can sense it that he's down? I can sense that he needs a word of prayer. Should I say, oh, I may be embarrassed. Somebody else may see me doing that. He may be embarrassed. She may be embarrassed. We have to add into the equation that it doesn't matter what the world sees. It doesn't matter how the world views us. It all matters what the Lord sees. Boaz wasn't worried about his reputation here. It was all about Ruth. It was all about Naomi. It was all about his obedience to a covenant-keeping God. God's favor was more important than acquiring a name in this world. Now, sometimes we don't have to wait for the good things to occur. The rewards can happen instantly, as it does right here. We don't always want the praise of people, but think about this. As soon as he had presented this, and as soon as the other redeemer said, you buy it, and he takes his sandal off and he gives it to him, it's a done deal. And the people at the gate and the elders at the gate begin to praise him for what he's done. Then all the people were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together build up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, who Tamar bore to Judah because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman. The blessings that the townspeople gave to them may have been a conventional blessing. Many people believe this was some type of a conventional blessing that would be given to a newly engaged couple. But it had served much more than simply the conventional blessing. This had amazing significance to Boaz and to Ruth, because Ruth was unable to bear children up to this particular point. 10 years she was married to Mahlon, and not able to bear children. And what do we have here? The blessings are instantly handed out to her. Look at verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Only two places do we find the Lord as part of the active subject of an active verb in this book, where the Lord is actually doing something. Beforehand, in verse 1 and 6, we see that the Lord visited the people and gave them food. And now we see that the Lord gave her conception. This is part of next week's message. Underlying perspective of this entire book is God himself is actively at work in the midst of this. The Lord is the one that gave her conception. She wasn't able to conceive under Mahlon, but now she's able to conceive a son for Boaz. Think of the other blessings that became immediately evident here. The reward of obedience instantly is given to Naomi. Listen to what they say. Naomi in her old age has a kinsman redeemer, something that she was lacking when she first came back, not understanding at all, and just could see nothing but the emptiness in her hands. Nothing to give. I'm come back empty. And now they bring a baby to her. And they put it in her lap. And they say, this is yours. This is part of your lineage. This is part of God's promise to you. And they say in verse 14, blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you as a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. Amazing picture, isn't it? Here's an amazing picture of kindness. It's an amazing picture of love that we have here at the very end. That Naomi, who was basically, we see her at the beginning of this story, so totally empty in her life, now is given complete fullness in it through God's providence and his work. Naomi took the child and laid it on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave her a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He's the father of Jesse, the father of David. So here in Naomi's lap is a grandson. A clear, absolute, clear clarity picture of God bringing out of emptiness fullness. Taking us from chapter 1, where it's an amazing picture that there is nothing in her hands whatsoever. He has replaced it with complete fullness through his own grace. No one could bring back her husband. No one's going to bring back her sons. But for these people to proclaim to her the blessings that are upon her life and the accolade that they give her in the Old Testament times when they said that she is more precious than seven sons to her is an amazing accolade of God's provision to her in the fullness, what God has brought. What we see, the greater picture here, as I looked at this, I'm going to skip ahead so I can make sure I get this point in my notes. As I looked at this, and I realized, why do you end a story such as this? A story which I believe has wrongly been taught over the years by many churches and pastors as a love story between Ruth and Boaz. Why do you end it with a genealogy? And that's almost bad writing. Unless you have a purpose in it, and then it's perfect writing. And I believe there is a perfect reason. I believe there is an absolute purpose in this genealogy that's at the very end. The genealogy links together, looks back into Israel's history, and looks forward into Israel's history also. It's a theme that you're going to continually see back and forth, I believe, in the continuity of the two scriptures, or the two halves of our scriptures between the Old Testament and the New Testament. It's a continuity that we see continually played out here in these genealogies, because we see that this is a partial fulfillment to a promise given to Abraham by God years and years and years beforehand, that we will bless. God says, "I will bless. I will bless your nation. And through you, all nations are going to be blessed." And so where do we see the all nations being blessed then from? You get a picture of it from the fact that Ruth, who is not a Jewess, is actually incorporated into the covenant family. And we've looked at that over the last several weeks also. So we get a picture that all nations are being blessed through this. But it really comes to complete picture in the line of Christ himself. If you would go to the book of Matthew, and we don't have time this morning to look at Matthew, you see that Matthew begins with a genealogy. And it's boring to read. Okay, you just got to go through all of them. Okay, right back to the very beginning, da 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 da, all the way down to you finally get down to the Christ. So it's a picture, though. The genealogies are absolutely essential for us to be able to understand what is going on. When we begin to look at this lineage, we begin to see the purposes of these lineages that are being handed out. We see that Christ himself is going to be given this amazing lineage of filthy people, not real wholesome people. I mean, you just don't see the best of the best in Jesus' lineage. I began to look at this. I mean, why do they call out a blessing about Tamar, for goodness sake? Just before the lineage is given, "Oh, may you guys have kids like Tamar and Judah did." I don't know if you remember the story of Tamar in Genesis chapter 38, but it's not a pretty story. This is going to make this one of these PG, or maybe even R-rated if it was given out in its entirety, messages. But Tamar, the daughter-in-law of Judah, doesn't have any kids. And so she wants to have a kid to Judah. So she pretends to be a prostitute. And Judah, oh, yeah, okay. So he goes into her, and they end up having children. They're calling down blessings of Tamar, somebody who hid who she actually was and pretended to be a prostitute, dressed up like one and went into them, and so that they can continue this lineage. You go back further and you look at these people that are within Jesus' lineage in Matthew chapter 18. You see Ruth. Ruth is not a Jew. She's a Moabite. She's a pagan. She's from one of the outside of the promised people. You think of the other women that is within that. You think of Rahab. She didn't play the part of a prostitute. She was a prostitute. And so it's the same thing. We see her in the lineage here. Somebody that is actually protected because of her faith in God, protected from the destruction of Jericho, she's in the lineage. Think of Bathsheba. Many times we don't look upon Bathsheba as having done too much wrong because of the contrasting of what all David has done. But she was complicit. She was complicit in the adultery. Takes two. She's complicit in all of the covering up. She knows about Uriah and where he's been placed and out in front of the battle. She's complicit in all of that. And she's in the lineage. And then you think of the men that is in Jesus' lineage. You think of Judah. Well, Judah, you know, you got Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and then Judah. I mean, he's one of the big four. He went in knowingly to lie down with a prostitute. Happens to be his daughter-in-law, Tamar. Still without any qualms about it, he does. Think about David. He's in the line. A man after God's own heart. But a mastermind and a co-conspirator in murder and in adultery. And in Manasseh, he's in his line. One of the most idolatrous kings of Judah ever. And from his time on, the fact that the people were going to go into exile was a foregone conclusion. He was that idolatrous. That's Jesus' lineage. Why would you record that? Why would you want that type of thing recorded? I began to look at that and asking myself this at 2:30 this morning, and that's when I rewrote this. It's a remarkable procession, if you will, of unwashed and soiled people. Why would Jesus, who could descend from any line he possibly wanted, why would Jesus descend from such a soiled line? Why? Because Jesus is a friend of sinners. Bottom line, he is a friend of sinners. How was Jesus known when he walked this earth? You eat with tax collectors. You hang with the prostitutes. You run with the thieves. You find yourself downtown with all of the riffraff whatsoever. That's right. That's how I'm known. I don't hang out with the clean people. I don't hang out with the upper echelon people. It's amazing when you begin to think about it. He came to rescue sinners. So if he's going to rescue sinners, where does he have to spend his time? He's got to spend his time with the sinners. He doesn't come into this world. I began to think about this. Could Jesus have saved us from heaven? Could God have saved us from heaven and not come down? Could he come down maybe like a scientist in one of those suits that, you know, is all sealed off and everything sealed inside and no germs are going to get again whatsoever? Could Jesus have done it that way? Now, don't give me the argument he can do anything. I submit to you, he couldn't. He couldn't do it. He had to come and live amongst us. He had to be known as one of the outcasts. He had to know the one of the people that ran with the criminals. He dies between two thieves, naked, exactly how he came into the world, with nothing. It's exactly who Jesus is. has no worldly honor whatsoever. He leaves. He comes into the midst of scandalous conditions. His mother has him out of wedlock. And he dies scandalous as a murderer and a thief himself. Nobody knows why he's even dead upon a cross. That's Jesus. Why? It's the only way that he could save sinners. He couldn't save them in any other way. He came down and lived amongst us. He lived with the suffering. He lived with the trials. He lived with the temptations. And in everything was without sin. Faced temptation that you and I would never, ever face. And all because someday when he paid the penalty of sin by his death upon a cross, the righteous living that he was able to maintain in the midst of all of this suffering and in all of this sin was credited to your account. That's why he had to live in the midst of it. So my question is, do we become friends of sinners? Ruth has. Ruth has known it. Ruth said, "My existence, Naomi, is for you. Where you go, I go. Your people are my people. Your God is my God. I promise you, I will die where you are. Nothing is going to separate me from you. Naomi, I'm your friend." Think of Boaz's friendship to Ruth. "I don't know who you are right now, but it is a friendship of this world. You're gleaning in the field. Apparently you're poor." And he's attracted to that. He's attracted to the fact that he needs to exemplify what Christ is to the rest of this world. The question then is, can people like Ruth and like the rest of these people that we've studied, do they find a similar welcome at our church? Do they find the same type of welcome here at Center Hill and in our homes? Is our place and our homes a place that the last and the least and the lost can be comfortable? Began to think about that this week and specifically this morning. How about, is our church a safe place for people with notorious lives outside of our congregation? Do they feel it? That this is a safe place? They're not going to be judged. They're not going to be stared at. Oh, the gospel is going to be presented. Wrong is going to be cried out. But they're not going to be judged. They're not going to be stared at. They're going to be given some type of eternal value, some type of eternal worth through the finished work of Jesus Christ. Is that how people see us? Are we welcoming to those people? We see them come in our church or know that they're associated with the church. Do we take time to go speak to them? Or do we speak to those people which already know a little bit about how we speak? They're somewhat religious. Oh, they're attending another church somewhere and they're not really satisfied with it. Well, that means that they're probably already Christians. So come and sit with me. Or how about the guy who simply walks out of jail for the first time, and we know why he was in jail? Do we walk up to him and say, "Come and sit with me"? You don't smell real good, but come and sit with me anyways. How's our church known? Each of us has a role to play when people walk through the doors of this church. Do we welcome them? Do we talk with them? Do we invite them into our homes? Do we make them feel important? Do we make them feel like you have worth in the finished person work of Jesus Christ? Do we say that you are of eternal value to our Heavenly Father? That's what Ruth did for Naomi. At the lowest point in her life, Ruth made it clear, "I am bound to you for life. Nothing will separate me from you." A picture that Ruth also felt from Boaz. Valuable human being. Though an outsider, a widower from Moab, for goodness sakes. Think about it, though. All of that is exactly what the Lord has done for each of us today. Exactly what, when you and I were the filthiest of filth, God sought us out. When we were his enemy, he sought us out. He loved us before we ever loved him. He made us feel valuable. Now, I submit to you, he made us actually valuable in Jesus Christ. That's what we've had done for us. Why can we do anything else other than that? Ruth's story is part of a bigger narrative than Ruth could ever have imagined. No idea when she left Moab to follow Naomi where she was going to be placed in the lineage of the Messiah himself. Your story, my story, is woven into that amazing tapestry that God is redeeming a people for himself. We're part of a tapestry that we don't know. We don't know where it ends. We know how it ends. But we're part of that tapestry of what God is doing through his redemptive work of his son, Jesus Christ. Think about this, folks. In Jesus, we have been given an amazing genealogy. And that is children of God. Children of God. You are written into the lineage as children of God. How can we do anything less other than to treat others the same way?